This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Play the phone on the show.
It is Danny and Gallant. It is time for Blue 42. We're going to have a pinch hitter today. We're going to do a little bit of potpourri of various opinions that have been around the NFL. Brock Heward will be back with us tomorrow, but let's get it going. Time for Blue 42.
Here we go.
This is Blue 42.
We're going to go red, right, tight, close, sprint left, GU corner, halfback, flat, on two. Ready, fight!
Now here's your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Blue 42! Blue 42!
Morning, everybody. How are you now?
We're doing okay. We're hanging together. Figuring it out. Jeremy
Shepard. Brock impression?
Good morning, yeah. Pauly.
Yeah. Let's start off by that Jeremy Shapp piece of sound.
Okay.
When he talked about defending your quarterback and the idea that you maybe should just wait and see what you get rather than trading up into the top three. Here's what Shapp had to say about the history of quarterbacks being drafted that high.
I mean, seriously, is Zach Wilson really better than Sam Darnold? Who knows? Maybe he's the next Johnny Unitas. Maybe he's the next Geno Smith. In 2017, the Bears traded four picks to move up one spot to draft Mitchell Trubisky at second overall. They could have kept all those picks and taken Patrick Mahomes with room to spare. He went 10th. With the exception of the rare, very rare, almost impossibly rare sure thing, a la John Elway or Peyton Manning, you're probably better off using that top pick on an offensive lineman or linebacker. Late in the first round, after all, you can get an Aaron Rodgers. Or in the second, a Drew Brees. Or if you wait all the way until the sixth, Tom Brady. In the last 50 NFL drafts, 44 quarterbacks have been selected first, second, or third overall. And exactly two have gone on to win Super Bowls as the starters for the teams that drafted them. Troy Aikman and Peyton Manning.
Let me flip this around, Paul, because there's some merit to what he's saying.
It's more who he leaves out in the argument that makes it a little disingenuous. But I'm with you on that front.
That's part of it, is that, hey, Terry Bradshaw was drafted 51 years ago, so that's a convenient place to end it at 50 because he won four Super Bowls for the team that drafted him. Also, by saying the team that drafted them, you play semantics in that John Elway and Eli Manning are not included on that list, even though each player only played for one team in their history and each won two Super Bowls, right?
Another like, four Super Bowls into the mix.
So all of that's disingenuous. How many teams that draft number one overall or in the top three overall have won a Super Bowl in the past 50 years? I mean, A, when you're that bad a team, it's unlikely whoever you draft that you're going to win a Super Bowl, the overall scheme of things. That's the first part of it. The second is that bad teams draft in those spots. The most inept, who's drafted up there a ton? The Cincinnati Bengals.
The Buccaneers.
The Browns. Right. Bad teams. Bad franchises. And in some ways, you're like, poor Carson Palmer for going to that team because he got drafted by a team that's never going to win. Poor Joe Burrow because he would have been a championship quarterback if he hadn't gotten drafted into that sad sack organization that's always drafted in the top three.
You also can look at Jameis Winston by that very same Buccaneers team taken first overall, and they move on from him and they win a Super Bowl the first year.
Well, that's funny.
But there's also the element of Tom Brady kind of ruins all of these arguments, doesn't he? And in this exception, it's, hey, look, there's a Hall of Fame veteran available for us in free agency.
I think there's also a difference between trading up for a quarterback in the top three and picking a quarterback in the top three. I don't know if it's ever worthwhile to trade up for the quarterback. Man, that's because you give up a ton. And that's really, I don't know what the 49ers are doing. Like, that's an awful lot to give up to move into the top three to take the third best quarterback in a draft where it seems like people are really desperate for quarterbacks.
And to make the trade now as well, unless they were paranoid somebody else was going to get into that spot, that's really the only reason I could see maybe them deciding to pull the trigger on the move now. Because I will say, you go back in time to not quite the top 10, but the Chiefs and the Texans trading up to go get Patrick Mahomes and Deshaun Watson, respectively, in the exact same draft after Mitchell Trubisky. I mean, those moves, I think, made a whole lot of sense.
I would agree with you, But those are what? Deshaun Watson went 10th?
I think 12, and Mahomes was 10.
Mahomes went 10. It's different when you go into that top two, usually, and top three now, because San Francisco's done it to get to the third. It's a whole like you basically set on fire your draft pick charts and all those different things. Like, and you just pay through the nose for them. When the Falcons did it, they traded with the Chargers to draft Vic, right?
Yeah.
The Eagles did it to draft Wentz. You also had that year.
The Rams,
you also
too.
Had the Rams trading
with the Titans
to draft Goff, and then Washington. And that was a trade to the Rams so they could draft Robert Griffin III. You basically just pay through the nose to do that. It's hard to justify that price. It's hard to justify that price to trade up to get that quarterback if you're outside, if you're not in one of those top one, two, or three spots. I think it's different when you draft a quarterback and you're holding on to that pick.
Oh, no doubt about that. Look, I mean, Jeremy Schapp has a point in that, yeah, it's probably not optimal to go about it that way. But the problem is you do need to go about it that way if you want to get your guy. Otherwise, you're stumbling or lucking into the person. And you can't operate by stumbling or lucking into things, you know? You can't operate with the assumption that, yep, we'll find Tom Brady. Or, yep, we'll find Russell Wilson in the back of the draft.
There was a point in time, and it was a really fun year. Maybe it was like a year and a half, where people thought that Seattle had just absolutely screwed up by drafting Aaron Curry fourth overall, which they did. But the reason that they really screwed up was because, they could have had Sanchez. They could have had Sanchez. He went to back-to-back AFC championship games. They could have had Sanchez. When you get in the top four, you don't pick a linebacker there. You pick a quarterback. They should have taken Sanchez. Newsflash, that wouldn't have worked either.
Why didn't they watch Sanchez? Because if you had watched Sanchez, you would know that he was very lucky to have gotten along on those two rides to the AFC Championship game. Though he did play well in the one against the Steelers.
Also, Seattle was better off having Curry than Sanchez because it's easier to cut ties with a linebacker drafted number four overall than it is with the quarterback who you build your team around.
I.e. Jared Goff.
Yeah, you have two more years where you basically talk yourself into the fact that this might still be the guy.
Tannehill.
And with the linebacker, you're just like, oh, dude, this guy stinks. Play KJ Wright, trade him to the Raiders. Question two.
Okay, so Danny.
And Paul Gallant.
Blue 42.
We saw on Friday the Seahawks brought a guy back in Demarius Randle. It doesn't seem like it's that big of a move. Then we hear that they are moving him from safety back to cornerback, which I found surprising because he had been a cornerback in Green Bay. I thought he was a good cornerback in Green Bay, though I tweeted that out. Corbin Smith said apparently he gave out like 18 touchdown passes or something like that as a cornerback, which might have led to him getting traded to Cleveland where he got moved to safety. Here's Pete Carroll from last year talking about why the Seahawks had Demarius Randle, a former cornerback. Here's Pete Carroll last year just talking about Demarius Randle.
Yeah, he's played corner in his past, and he always felt like he was a safety and felt like he's been at his best in his history. I mean, I see it that way, too, watching the film and all that. He was so fast that everybody wanted to try him at corner. That was the thought. But he's most at home playing on the back end.
I was surprised by that, Danny. Do you think a move to cornerback that there is any chance that Demarius Randle can give the Seahawks an actual competitive option at starting corner?
Sure. A chance? Yeah. You've always got a chance. Do I think he's going to get meaningful snaps at cornerback this year? No. The percentage chance, I would say, 5 to 10%. Dudes don't move back to corner later in their career. That's not how it works, right? Don't you move closer to the middle of the field? The edges is where you need the fastest dudes. The edges of the football field should be similar to the left-handed lane. Only the very fastest drivers drive on the left-hand lane. Everybody else move to the right. Only the very fastest football players should be at the edge of the field.
It's a really good point. Why do you think they're moving him back then?
Because they don't see a long-term fit for him at safety.
But they brought him back. If you don't see a long-term fit for him at any position, then why are you bringing him back?
Money, because you've got 90 dudes on the roster.
Yeah, fair.
You need people to play preseason games. Everybody needs bodies, Paul. You need bodies. And right now, Quentin Dunbar left, so you need another body. Isn't that the crassest thing that football players and people will say? Like, do you need more bodies at that position? It's like, good God, you're just running out there and putting them into some sort of meat grinder? We got to get another body out here in these drills.
Cobra Kai would have approved of that.
Oh,
my favorite part of
bag?
My favorite part of Karate Kid is that one guy who just yells,
"Yeah, put him in a body bag!
Yeah, Johnny, put him in a body bag! Get him a body bag!" It's fantastic. Best part of the movie.
There was one of my moments, and it's not heckling because it was on TV. It was watching a UFC event there in Lower Queen Anne. God, I can't remember the name of the bar that's there now. It's right next to where Oscars is, that on the corner. I'll think of it. And it got kind of quiet, and I yelled, "Yeah, put him in a body bag!" Killed. Just slayed with that comment.
Did people look at you? Was there laughter?
Yeah, laughed.
Oh,
everybody
nice.
Thought it was fun.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay. Well played.
Question three. All right, Kerry Hyder. He's a member of the Seattle Seahawks, and it sounds like he's fitting right into our feelings when it comes to the... What are their colors? Is it gold and red? It's not maroon and gold. What are the 49ers' colors? What's their shade of red?
They have the same shade of red as the Kansas City Chiefs, apparently. Right?
Oh, really?
I think. Or maybe it's the Bucks who have the same shade of red as the Kansas City
Chiefs. No, they
have
pewter, don't they? No, pewter's the gray. I don't know. Tampa Bay's is kind of orange.
It's red.
Yeah, it's a very red. It's kind of a soft shade of red. The Chiefs red, I always thought, looks like the red from little kids' pajamas. And you put it with that mustard yellow, like the color of traffic stripes. Looks like the pajamas little kids would wear. Kerry Hyder doesn't like the 49ers. He explains.
Sorry, I got caught up looking their uniform colors up. It says scarlet.
Scarlet!
Oh, that sounds very highfalutin. That's the color of my ascot. Here's Kerry Hyder.
There's no love lost there. You know, I'm excited to be a Seahawk, and I'm definitely looking forward to all division games.
No love lost is an interesting thing to say, considering he did have 8.5 sacks for the 49ers last year. You would think that he might have enjoyed his time there, but maybe not. Is he upset that he didn't get the extension? Or are we perhaps reading too much into it where he's saying there's no love lost?
I think that guys tend to get it in their feelings if they don't get brought back after they perform really well for a team. I get it. If you're him, you're like, "Hey, I just had the best year of my career, and you guys weren't that interested in bringing me back." Yeah. Heck yeah. We welcome that sort of pettiness here. We're all for that sort of pettiness. Take it out on them. Show them, big boy. Show them what they're missing out on.
Bring the rivalry back, too. Because you have Akella Witherspoon, you have Kerry Hyder, you have DJ Reed.
Dude, I take a lot of shots at the 49ers. The best thing you can do in football is find the most talented team in the league and take the guys that don't make their roster. Honestly, like, the best thing you can do. Who's got the best defense in the league? Go get me players 54, 55, and 56 off of that roster. It worked that way with the Seahawks for years. With 2012, 2013, go find the corners which defensive backs do not make their team. Guy like Ron Parker, who ended up making money in Kansas City. Find the best defense you can, and then go find the guys that barely make that. Will Blackman was another guy. He didn't make the team here, and he was a really productive NFL player. I think that's a great way to find good guys.
That has been their strategy. I mean, and this is, I would say, in the NFC.
49ers are great defense, right?
Right.
I mean, 49ers have been awesome for the past 3 years. Their defense has been phenomenal.
I think you have to, at the very least, over the last 2 years, even with some of the injuries that they had last year, say that, yeah, last two seasons, I think that their body of work is probably the most complete. The Bucs are probably second, but it took them a while to get going in 2019. And second half of 2019 in this entire past season, a little bit different. But, yeah, you're right. And, man, they have gone about that strategy. John Schneider clearly thinks very highly of these guys who are on the San Francisco 49ers, and I'm all for it. I mean, DJ Reed, he came in and he played really well, and that was a guy that, I mean, clearly the 49ers were trying to sneak wave him with the injury that he had suffered.
We got a couple good texts here. That is Blue 42. Brock Heward will be back with us tomorrow. From the 509, Russ's agent was already on Tinder and told you of 4 hookups. If your wife says, "I don't want a divorce, but here are 4 guys I'm interested in," if it happens, the Rubicon has already been crossed. 509's got a fair point there.
Yeah.
if you draft a quarterback in the second round, you're just like, "Hey, what's good for the goose is good for the gander."
How do you get over that? I mean, as an organization, you see that put out there. Do you need to have some sort of acknowledgement from Russell Wilson, or are you just rolling your eyes and saying, "Okay, well, cool, nice, Mark Rogers, we're moving on"?
that he said those?
Yeah.
If you're the team, honestly, you're thankful. If you're like, oh, let's see how that plays for you in public. Like, did that move help Russell?
No.
Like, that was a terrible strategic move. Just from a, there was nothing that that accomplished. Like, that was, and it was an ill-advised, it didn't engender any sympathy for him. It showed no power because, what, it got you a completely inadequate offer from the Chicago Bears? Like, what came out of that? If I was Russ, I'd be furious that that was a decision that was made or somebody didn't talk me out of that. Like, that was, that accomplished nothing.
It really
did. Like, that made, all that did was make you look bad.
And those options, too, that you wanted to go to did not seem that enthused about you. I mean, isn't that surprising, too? Like, obviously, Dallas had the Dak Prescott extension, something they'd been thinking about for a while. But you would think that just knowing Jerry Jones, that Jerry would have done something as close to tampering as possible. And there was no real interest, even with all of that.
Yes.
At least publicly.
I agree with that part. That it probably was a little bit of a reality check that Dallas did not see that as such a significant upgrade that it was like, stop what you're doing because I'm about to ruin all these plans that we've made for your future. The other part, and we glossed over this, one of the teams he picked out, Las Vegas, followed and proceeded to deconstruct its offensive line,
yeah.
Right? Rodney Hudson, its center. Gabe Jackson, its guard, traded a tackle in Trent Brown. If that was the list that my agent came up with, I was like, why did you not know that was going to happen?
Yeah.
Right? Because that doesn't come out of nowhere. And I'm sure that there were other teams that were aware that, okay, Las Vegas is about to pull the plug on its offensive line. And one of the four teams that you picked, it putatively because you want better protection to get hit less frequently. First of all, has an offensive line coach in Tom Cable, who's the primary reason that you got clobbered for those last 9 years. And then secondly, that traded all its good or let go of all of its good offensive linemen. Like that's what, why do we put them on the list? Like that wasn't very smart.
Yeah. And those were just weird options. They really were. I mean, you want to work for Gruden? I mean, I'm pretty sure Russ has paid enough attention to John Gruden over the last couple of years, regardless of any person one-on-one conversations that they had back in the day. He's got to notice that it's been a disaster for the Raiders in 3 years.
Yeah, but Gruden loved him so much and is fawned over him so much. I bet Russ is like, hey, that's the perfect person to bring the best out of me. Over the weekend, the Mariners take 2 of 3. They rallied yesterday, scoring another time where they got runs late to get themselves out of a hole against the Minnesota Twins. They were down 6-0 entering the sixth inning. Things got a little bit spicy later. We've got a cut from Scott Service. We'll play here in just a second, in which he talked about he ended up getting ejected. And the sequence of events was very funny that led to his ejection. We had some spice. And this is one that you want to file away in your memory banks of. There was a little tension between the Mariners and the Twins, and it started, I would say it started over the course of the series, the way they pitched Ty France, who's been one of the Mariners' better hitters. And they were pitching him in tight, which certainly is a strategy that you're going to see teams use, especially as they try to figure out what his weaknesses are. But in the latter half of the game, he got busted up and in twice, and the second time he got hit and was understandably displeased about that. And after that, the Mariners, well, they hit the number three hitter. Usually when there's a tit for tat, it's either a guy that plays the same position or a guy that occupies the same spot in the order. This wasn't quite that case. Buxton is the Twins' number three hitter. By the way, it looks like an MVP candidate. I don't know where the power came from that he is clobbering the ball. France hits number two, and it was also a changeup, but the umps got together and decided they were going to administer a warning, which Scott Service did not take kindly to, came out hollering, and ended up getting tossed because he was mad. I enjoyed the feistiness from the skipper, Paul.
I like seeing it, too. Does that have an actual impact? I've always wondered about this. When a manager gets tossed from a game, there was a video game called MVP Baseball where you could, I think, argue a call, and if the manager got ejected, sometimes it might provide your team with like a ratings boost. Now, this is a video game, not a real thing, but do you think a manager getting thrown out of a game actually makes a player maybe a little bit more fired up, a little bit better in their approach, or is it actually a disaster because all of a sudden you've taken the guy who's making most of the decisions out of the game?
I think it can help. I know it doesn't hurt. There is nothing to lose. The manager's primary function in a baseball franchise is not the day-to-day manage, like the in-game decision making. That's part of it, but I would say that that's 10 to 20% of his job. Most of it is understanding his personnel and whether it is massaging hurt feelings over lack of opportunities or getting a guy to buy into a different role. Like, I think that's where most of it is. Getting ejected, especially late in a game, the bench coach knows exactly what you guys are going to do. Like, it's not even guys that manage or rely on their gut. Those decisions are so, I think that that's a dramatically overstated. I don't know if getting people mad. I know that players like it. I know that players enjoy seeing a manager stick up for them. And mostly, I like having a manager who gets feisty and gets sick of a crew. I think Scott Service was sick of those umps. And I was too by the end of it. Like Laz Diaz and whoever was behind home plate yesterday that was apologizing basically to Shoemaker over missing a pitch earlier.
That's
in
so
the inning.
Strange. I mean, why would you ever admit you're wrong as an umpire, right? If you're an ump, you always want to make it seem as if you are the correct guy out there. And I would imagine just flex, show that you are the law. We've seen it before with guys like Joe West. We've seen it with Angel Hernandez as well. And when you've got guys that are kind of like that, and you have the same umpires now 9 games in a row, I imagine that they probably had an idea of who was probably not on that front. And Scott Service gets ejected. And we'll see what happens the next time around when the Mariners play the Twins. And I believe that the next game between these two is going to be June 14th. So just a little bit around the corner. It's Danny and Gallant, 710 ESPN Seattle. Coming, we're gonna try to get Danny back with us because we had a little bit of a disconnection issue right now. So we will talk next about the Mariners and about their weekend and about a guy who used to play for the Mariners who maybe could redeem himself if he does what it's reported that he is about to do next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
A-Rod has, I wouldn't even say it's a strange history with Seattle. He has a difficult history with Seattle. And I would say that most fans, while someone like me has finally kind of gotten over some of it and likes A-Rod again, which has been surprising to me, he's not embraced here. That could all change depending on what would happen with an NBA team. And I saw this reaction across a number of places. A-Rod's going to be part of a group. He and a partner, a guy named Mark Lohr, who I did not know before but is apparently an e-commerce figure, are buying the Minnesota Timberwolves. The price is going to be $1.5 billion. Apparently, they're going to have a couple years where they work in conjunction with Glenn Taylor, who is the Target owner. A Minnesota businessman who's owned that team since it was an expansion franchise. And the immediate question for everybody in Seattle and even some people who've been watching the league in general was, hey, is A-Rod going to totally redeem himself in the eyes of the city he once left by bringing a basketball team back?
The whole process, he knew ahead of time. That's why he took that $250 million contract from the Rangers, because he knew that 20 years from now he would have the opportunity with more money in his pocket to buy the Seattle Supersonics. It was all a ploy, Danny.
I had not thought of it in that regard, but that there is something funny about the actual decision that Seattle was mad. If he were to bring a team back here, an NBA team back here, the decision that infuriated Seattle and Seattle felt betrayed by was actually the decision that and rationale that helped lead to him being able to do this.
Right.
Right. Like, there's something, I don't know whether it's an O. Henry ending or how you would describe that, but there is something that's very poetic about all of that.
I also look, Danny, at the Minnesota Timberwolves, and I know that you do not want to touch another man's rhubarb. I get it. But when I look at that team, of all the teams in basketball, just from a historical perspective, it's a franchise where there has not been a lot of success. They are relatively new. Their best moment is probably when Kevin Garnett won a title with the Celtics. Like, that's probably the greatest moment in Minnesota Timberwolves history. No real playoff success. I imagine there's not much love for the Timberwolves in town, given that Glenn Taylor has not been a particularly competent owner. If there was a team to take away from a city, which I know you're uncomfortable with, this is one of the ones where I feel like you are upsetting the least amount of people by taking it away. And of course, there would be some people that don't like it, but this is one of those teams that I think you look at and it's just, there's no history. They've only been there a little bit of time, and with no success, no history, no real fan base, I feel like this is easy. And I feel like this is something that you should, Danny, be more willing to get dirty for.
I'm not. Even as you start talking about the idea of whether or not they quote unquote deserve a team or how it would feel, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be a poacher. And if that means that you have to wait a little bit longer, I want an expansion team, or at the very least, I don't want to talk about acquiring another team. I don't want to talk about acquiring another team until they've said they're leaving. I don't want to mess with their marriage. I don't want to mess with their cohabitation. I don't want to mess with that. That franchise is spoken for right now. So any attempt to characterize their support or their economic arrangement or their viability feels dirty to me. And I watched how it all went down with Sacramento. It stinks. And if you don't get the team, it feels even worse. You feel lousy about it.
We really felt lousy about the attempt to try and get the Kings? Really?
Yes. It felt at the end of that, yes, it was skeevy. It was unbecoming. I thought Chris Hansen, who led the group to try and get it, at the end, he, as his final act, contributed to a local like citizens group that was opposing the establishment of the arena. Like, that was after his bid to buy the team had failed, and he was like, it was the final turd in the punch bowl on the way out. We're like, okay, I can't get your team. I'm going to try to wreck your path to the trough anyway. And it was, yeah, I thought Seattle looked terrible overall about how, and I include myself in that group about, we looked thirsty. We looked thirsty and desperate.
What year was this in?
2012, 2013.
Okay.
Would have been the primary years of pursuit.
And I know that David Stern was, he still had his hands all over everything at that point in time. And
yes, David Stern was still alive at that point.
Right. So I feel that now there's no obstacles really in your way that could potentially prevent a return. And I don't think that you're going to end up losing at the end here, and Danny. And if you just sit and wait for an expansion franchise, when's that going to happen? You know, we hear about it all the time, but it's one thing to hear about it. It's another thing for it to actually take place.
See, it's not the viability or the possibility of the relocation. It's the actual act of doing it I object to. Don't mess with another. Like, don't sit there and it's to say that Minnesota doesn't deserve or shouldn't have a basketball team because Seattle needs to have one. No, if they're going to leave Minnesota, then leave Minnesota, and then we can talk about whether there's a second home here. I'm not going to be the person, I don't want to be the person that presents myself as, hey, I'm such a better alternative than that schlub that you're with. No one likes that guy. It's a terrible way to be. And I guess that's, even to this day, of the idea that Sacramento should have kept that team. They should have kept that team. Now, just because Seattle got hosed over by the NBA, which it did, and that's David Stern should have done for Seattle what he did for Sacramento. That doesn't mean what he did for Sacramento is wrong, though. And just because we got hosed by the NBA does not mean we should like line up to watch the NBA hose somebody else. Like, we shouldn't actively aid and abet that process. If they're going to leave, then leave, and then we'll talk about it. But I don't want to be the other dude.
I think you're looking at it wrong, though. This other dude notion, they are a corporation. They are a corporation that exists in a city that does not care about them because they are not good.
That's a judgment, though. That's an opinion you have, though. What means they don't care about them? Like, that's not a decision.
Why would you care about
them? Us to make.
They are somebody that needs a complete rebrand. And they need...
Well, they're going to get it with Alex Rodriguez, right? Like, they're going to get it with that. Why do we care about or what another team needs or that they would be better than...
Because it helps us
out. You're being... No, see, that's being the lame guy who's talking down about the spouse that you're with. Why are you with him? I make more money than he does. I drive a nicer car than he does. No one likes that guy, Paul. Everyone hates that guy, and they should because it's loathsome behavior.
I agree that is loathsome behavior, but You have to do
this. This is the exact same thing.
I don't think it's the same thing.
No,
at all.
You don't. You don't have to demean yourself. You don't have to bathe yourself in cologne and go out there and be some sort of lounge lizard type.
You know what? I'm fine being the lounge lizard type. I want the Sonics back. By any means necessary, Danny. That's what it should be.
No.
It's a basketball team.
Not be that. That's terrible.
Why not? And I've seen this happen in Houston. No one in Houston cares about the Texans the way that they cared about the Oilers. It's a different thing. They go off to Tennessee. You know what, though? I mean, they didn't build a new stadium. Stuff happens. I get why it went down that way, and I understand why there's hard feelings for the having departed franchise like there are for the Oklahoma City Thunder here. But guess what? This is how it's done. This is the only way that you can do it. And if you just sit back and, like, expect it to happen, nothing comes. You got to take it. That's what Jack Nicholson says in The Departed. His character, Frank Costello, I don't care if it means that I'm going to look twisted like a gangster like Frank Costello at the end of it. I will take that team by any means necessary. That is my pledge. I will steal it. I will steal it for you. If you don't want to get dirty, Danny, fine. I'll do it.
See, but that's – I don't want you doing that for me. And Frank Costello is not the good guy in that movie. Like,
who
Frank
is
Costello
the good guy
is
in that
not
movie?
The person who – Well, there's a lot of room for debate about that. And actually, like, the movie that it's based on, Infernal Affairs, which is a Hong Kong movie, does it even better about who actually is the good guy. But Frank Costello very clearly is the bad guy. He's not the person who should be our moral compass in this situation. No. What about the kid in Minnesota who's 14 years old and loves the Timberwolves? Like, what about him? And you say, like, you don't like – your city doesn't like that team as much as we would. Your city doesn't deserve this team as much. Like, what did he do to deserve that? And when you go in and play this screw-your-neighbor game, which is essentially what NBA relocation is, I'm out. I don't want any part of the neighborhood. Once that person wants to move out and declares that they've gotten all their stuff into a moving van and relocated, like, then I'm willing to talk to them. But as it goes, I'm not going to try to outbid. I'm not going to try to outtalk about, oh, it's a better market size and all of these things, because it's gross. It's disgusting. And everybody in Oklahoma City that felt that way about stealing this team, that's why I hope that that team brings them nothing but pain. I hope it's cursed, and I think that the lack of success that that franchise has had and the heartbreak speaks to the fact that there's a deeper karmic price to pay.
But if you don't believe in karma, then, again,
you're
hold
doing
up.
This Gordon Gekko thing.
Yes.
Like, you need to,
good.
We need to get you to watch some better movies.
No, that's not good.
That's morally, like... It's amoral. It's gross.
I hate that you brought up the small 14-year-old kid. Like, that's going to change my mind on that. Look, I once was a 14-year-old kid that would have been devastated if my team had left town. But here I am in Seattle without a basketball team. I miss the NBA. I miss it. And how do you get it back? You got to get dirty. You got to do it. And guess what? I feel bad for that 14-year-old theoretical child that now is being used essentially as like a – some sort of a PSA, like he's got one tear going down his face or something like that. I don't care.
Yes, he does.
I need that team.
Think about him. All he loves, he has Kevin Love's jersey on. He believes
Carl
in his
Anthony
forefather,
Towns.
Kevin Garnett. This poor kid has talked himself into the idea of being excited about Andrew Wiggins being drafted first overall, watched his team let Jimmy Butler walk away or traded him before he went to free agency, and now you're going to take his team.
Yep, I'm going to steal.
Now you're going to take his team.
Listen, if you feel dirty about it, fine, but someone's got to get dirty.
Don't be Paul. Don't be Paul.
Happiness
All
is
right.
worth
we're gonna,
the squeeze,
we're gonna go until We're going to go in a little bit different direction, a little less married poaching conversations.
That's a lot of
a little more dating game. Yeah, it's the draft dating game. That's next here on Danny and Gallant.
You are listening to Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
And we're about to play the hit game show that's sweeping the country. Oh, of course, it's the draft dating game with your host, Maura Dooley. Maura, walk us through this.
Hey, guys. So we can have a little fun here with the draft.
Yes. Let's make a match.
Yeah. So I have three lovely contestants or prospects, if you will, that have been mocked to go to the Seahawks by different analysts. For their first pick, it seems pretty offensive line heavy. So we have, it's all offensive line. I'll go through each one without their names or their school, and you guys tell me who you would want to. Who you'd be interested in hearing more about as your first pick for the Seahawks. So first up, we have a center. He's 6'4", 312 pounds. Some of the positives that are listed for him are dynamic zone-blocking center, who started 3 years in college, fundamentally sound, explosive at the point, fires into blocks, has outstanding vision, and keeps his head on a swivel. Terrific with a shotgun snap.
I like the key. I like it keeping his head on a swivel. Do we have there were some occasional issues with the snaps last year, right?
Yeah, especially when Damian Lewis had to step in for that one game.
Oh, that's true.
That was a rough one. That was a rough one. But that's not his position, so it's okay, Damian. You're fine.
The negatives for this guy? Not a big mauling center who gets a lot of movement in run blocking.
Oh.
Must improve his strength at the point.
Yeah.
All right. They've all got negatives, so we'll see.
Okay.
All right. Let's see. Prospect number two. This is also a center.
Okay.
He's 6'3", 320 pounds. So a little heavier. Yeah.
He's shorter, though.
So the positives on him. Dominant.
Compact.
Yeah. Joey Hunt. No. dominant small school blocker who has been on the rise since January.
Small school.
Built low to the ground. What do they call that with Puna? Built-in leverage? Yeah.
Yes. Got good leverage.
So he bends his knees and blocks with leverage. Oh, there it is. Leverage. Explosive at the point. Strong and dominates opponents or controls them at the point. Gets movement and run blocking and steals defenders from the action or engulfs them altogether. Keeps his feet moving, works his hands, and blocks with a nasty attitude.
Ooh. Okay, well, that last part, up to that point, I don't know if I was really feeling it, but that last part with a nasty attitude, okay, that makes up for small school blocker on the rise since January, because I hate it when prospects are on the rise since January. It makes no sense to me. Like, how is this person all of a sudden on the rise? Why?
Right, because he hasn't played any football, right?
Right.
And that's, you're always leery of drafting someone who is testing, like, based on how they're testing rather than, like, how they actually played. Do you worry about small school prospects, or do you like small school prospects?
It really depends. Having worked with a former defensive lineman who played at a small school, who played at Cornell, and Seth Payne, it has always been a little bit more palatable going after small school guys. But I do always think when you have a guy that's playing at that level and he has not gone up against the terrifying forces that you see in the SEC on defensive lines everywhere, I feel like there is a real benefit to having played in a big conference. And I would just point at Damian Lewis as an example. You know, coming straight out of college in a weird year, he played at LSU on a great offensive line, blocked some great players, and he stepped in, and I think he did a really good job. Now, again, I'm not going to act like I'm a Mensa when it comes to offensive line studies, but I would prefer that the guy went to a bigger school.
Now, Seattle's former GM before Pete Carroll, John Schneider got here, before John Schneider took over the personnel department, was Tim Ruskell, hated small school prospects. Like, he was like, don't bring a guy in here if he didn't play in a Power 5 school. And there were some exceptions, but not many. And his thought was, you have to be able to, what are the odds of you being able to even survive an NFL training camp? Like, if you've been at a Power 5 school and gotten on the field there, I know you can work your way up a depth chart. I know that you're able to do that. See, under Schneider, they've been much more willing to take small school guys. They've drafted much better under Schneider. And so there's part of me of like, I kind of like the willingness to go after smaller school prospects. And
okay,
I think I prefer prospect number two to number one, but we got one more to consider, correct?
Prospect number three.
Well, and then the negatives on two were top heavy, not overly effective in motion, and not a true zone blocking line.
Mm. Top heavy doesn't sound good.
But let's get to number three.
No.
So number three is six. It's a guard. So we have two centers, and now we have a guard. 6'3".
Just a regular guard. Just a Roger and Tacoma guard.
Yeah. he's 6'3", 344 pounds.
Whoa, 344? Oh, yeah.
His positives are massive, wide-bodied blocker, who is only effective in a small area.
Oh.
Starts with good knee bend, stays square and shows strength, fundamentally sound and blocks with leverage, keeps his head on a swivel again, remains disciplined with assignments, and always looking for someone to hit.
I like that.
Negatives, lumbers around the field.
Whoa.
Ineffective blocking in motion. not quick out to the second level and cannot pull across the line.
Everything I've heard after 344 pounds is a little concerning on this one. Like, massive, wide-bodied blocker, but only effective in a small area as he lumbers across the field. Man, I was excited about his size. Now I'm not so much.
Do you guys want to each pick one, or do you want to come to a consensus here?
Well, I think we should each decide who we would choose out of those three descriptions. The one thing I do want to point out, though, has there ever... I'm always leery of things that never have the opposite. Like, there's never... He's got his head on a swivel. Do you ever hear the opposite of that in a scouting report?
Yeah, he is like, totally unaware.
He's lost.
Yeah, doesn't see anybody.
Has blinders
like,
on. The,
like, his... Yeah. His hair is really unkempt. I was like, does anybody ever get complimented for kempt hair? Like, no, you're just unkempt or not. And that's what he's got his head on a swivel. Like, this guy doesn't see anything that's happening anywhere around him.
That's the kind of player you absolutely
I don't want a lumberer.
I don't like, either. I'm out on three.
He lumbers around. Yeah, I think I'm done on three, too. I think I'd choose number two. I like the small school guy. I'm a little concerned about him being top heavy, but at the very least, I want nasty offensive linemen. Like that's, and it sounds like he's got a little bit of spice to him. Like he's always looking to hit somebody. He's always looking for work. I think I'm in on the small school kid, the 322 pounder.
That's the only reservation I have with the small school kid too. I just like that he blocks with a nasty attitude. And you take a look at Prospect One, who we may have forgotten a little bit. Nothing about Prospect One jumps out, at least based off of what we have. And then the negative, not a big mauling center, must improve his strength. I don't want to hear about a guy that needs to improve his strength right away, you know? I want a guy who's got the nasty attitude straight out of school.
Well, then it looks like you guys chose Quinn Meinerz. It's Meinerz out of Wisconsin Whitewater. He is Todd McShay's pick for the Seahawks.
Wisconsin Whitewater.
Ooh.
I don't even know where that is.
Yeah.
But he's country strong.
You know, who might be a little. Yeah, and John Schneider. John Schneider's well versed in the backwoods of Wisconsin. So perhaps that's a fit in that regard as well.
Okay.
And then prospect number one was Creed Humphrey, center out of Oklahoma.
Oh, his name was Creed?
Yeah.
Oh, I kind of like that.
And then prospect number three was Deontay Brown, guard out of Alabama.
Ooh, third guy was an Alabama guy. Now it sounds different. Yeah.
See, that's why you got
to
go
blind. Doesn't. It doesn't sound to me. No, here's the thing. Like, we've had the big lumbering dude from Alabama before, and it didn't work out well in James Carpenter. Like, no thank you on Deontay. Hey, hope you have a great career, but that's not my choice. I kind of like, after hearing where they are from, I like the Wisconsin Whitewater guy.
Okay, that's our guy right now. It is the draft dating game. This was very fun, Moore. Thank you for putting that together. It's Danny and Gallant, 710 ESPN Seattle. A great weekend for the Mariners. Going into the weekend, things were not looking so hot. All of a sudden, this team is slapping dingers all over the place. Is this something they're going to be able to keep up? We'll talk about that next.